I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's November 29th, and we have a lot to talk about. And today, we're talking about disaster preparedness. A quick scan of the news on any given day should remind all of us that natural disasters can strike anywhere at any time. Whether it's massive snowstorms, earthquakes, wildfires, hurricanes, or floods, no one is immune when Mother Nature chooses to act up. That's why being prepared for a natural disaster is important for everyone. And if you're living with MS, it's even more important that you have your family's emergency preparedness plan in place. Joining me to talk about some of the things that people living with MS should consider in creating their emergency preparedness plan is Mary Casey Lockyer. Mary is the Senior Medical Advisor to National Disaster Operations at the American Red Cross. But before we get to my conversation with Mary Casey Lockyer, I want to share a conversation that I had last week with Dr. Aaron Kesselheim. Dr. Kesselheim is a researcher at Harvard's Brigham and Women's Hospital, and if you're on Lemtrada, Dr. Kesselheim could use your help. But I'm going to let him explain that himself. In a moment, we'll hear my conversation with Dr. Aaron Kesselheim. Dr. Aaron Kesselheim is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a faculty member in the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmacoeconomics in the Department of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. And Dr. Kesselheim and his colleague, Dr. Amit Sarpatwari, are working with the FDA to conduct research on a special drug safety program that I'll let him tell you about. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Kesselheim.
It's a pleasure to be here, John. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm hoping you can start us off by telling us what PORTAL is all about.
Sure. So PORTAL stands for the Program on Regulation, Therapeutics, and Law. PORTAL is the name of the research center that I founded at Brigham Women's Hospital about a decade ago. We are an interdisciplinary research center that focuses on prescription drug use and costs. We look at all different aspects of drug policy, from drug development through regulatory issues related to the FDA to prescription drug prices and the use of medications. Besides myself and Dr. Sarpatwari, there are two other faculty members. We have half a dozen or so postdocs. We have people with backgrounds in medicine, law, epidemiology, ethics, and we don't take any money from the pharmaceutical industry. So we are among the largest independent, which is to say non-industry affiliated academic research centers in the country that focus on the pharmaceutical market.
And can you tell my listeners what a REMS study is?
A REMS program is a program that is imposed on certain drugs by the Food and Drug Administration. REMS stands for Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategy. And what it is basically is it is additional requirements or restrictions on the prescribing of a drug that allows a drug with a particular safety issue that may not have otherwise been approved by the FDA to nonetheless be approved and remain on the market so that certain patients who may benefit from that drug will be able to access it. So there are certain drugs out there, for example, that are very dangerous to people who are pregnant. And otherwise, the FDA might have not allowed that drug to be approved. But instead, the FDA now has the ability to put a REMS on the drug, which is to try to limit prescribing of that drug in pregnant women. And so there are dozens of drugs out there that have these REMS programs associated with them. REMS programs can include anything from additional information that physicians are supposed to know before they can be allowed to prescribe the drug, additional information that patients are supposed to know before they can receive the drug, additional testing that patients must go through before they can receive the drug or while they're getting the drug to monitor certain side effects. So it can be a whole range of different possibilities.
And in this particular instance, one of the drugs you're looking at is Lemtrada. So how can my listeners help?
Sure. So we're doing a study right now with the FDA to try to understand how these additional restrictions affect patients. How do they provide such a burden on patients that patients don't take the drug? Do they give patients reassurance when they're taking the drug that they feel like if they did have any side effects that they would be able to be acted on? How well do patients understand why these are attached to the drug? And so I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to your listeners because we're looking in particular at the REMS program that's related to the drug Lemtrada, which is for adults with the relapsing form of MS, including relapsing remitting disease and active secondary progressive disease. And what this REMS does is it has certain requirements for physicians, for example, to evaluate how their patients are doing and to perform certain baseline examinations of the patient when they're prescribed the drug and when they're on the drug for a while. And then there also are certain requirements on patients for the REMS, such as completing a special enrollment form, learning about managing infusion reactions. Those kinds of additional responsibilities that patients getting other drugs for multiple sclerosis aren't required to go through. So what we're really interested in is connecting with patients who have multiple sclerosis and who are taking Lemtrada to try to understand what they're going through with this REMS program so that we can feed that information back to the FDA to improve REMS programs, not only for this drug, but for all drugs that are required to have them.
And if some of our listeners are taking Lemtrada and they think they'd like to participate, what do they need to do?
Well, basically, all they're going to need to do is go through a one-hour phone interview with us, and for which we can offer a fair honorarium for their time. So we have a bunch of questions that we've designed and worked on with FDA and other experts in the field. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a conversation for an hour about patient's experience with the REMS. And then we're going to pull together all of the information from all the patients we talk to in an aggregated way and provide that information back to the FDA and to the public in the form of published research articles to try to advance our understanding of Lemtrada and our understanding of multiple sclerosis and our understanding in particular of the REMS programs that the FDA has imposed on this and other drugs. So if there are patients out there who with MS who are taking Lemtrada and would like to contribute to our research, I would ask you to email either myself or Dr. Sarpatwari. My email address is akesselheim@bwh.harvard.edu. Amit's email address is asarpatwari@bwh.harvard.edu. And John, as I understand it, you'll put those email addresses on your website so that people can access them. And then just let us know and we'll schedule a convenient time to talk with you and we'll go from there.
Yes, I'll definitely have those email addresses in today's show notes to make it really easy for someone to reach out and contact you. And one detail about that participation, I was going to make an assumption, but I hate to do that, especially when you're right here to answer the question. When someone does choose to participate, the information they share with you is treated confidentially, correct?
Absolutely, fully confidentially. There will be no personal identifying information shared with FDA. Or beyond our conversation. And, all of our procedures are approved by the Brigham Women's Hospital IRB. So we have, full confidence that we'll be able to keep people's confidentiality.
Well, Dr. Aaron Kesselheim, I want to thank you for all you do to help ensure the safety of people who are taking a wide range of prescription medications. And thanks for reaching out to the Real Talk MS listener community today.
Very good. Thank you so much, John, for this opportunity. And we hope there are some people out there who are interested. And, thank you for all the great work that you do in trying to improve education around MS.
In the last couple of months alone, we've seen once-in-a-century blizzards, hurricanes, earthquakes, and flooding impact communities across the United States and around the world. We've seen people lose their homes. We've witnessed mass evacuations. And we've even seen Mother Nature trap people in their homes. Natural disasters can strike anyone, anywhere. And that's why your very survival sometimes comes down to whether or not you're prepared. If you're living with MS, you have some additional considerations to make when you put together your disaster preparedness plan. You need to think about medications, some of which may require refrigeration. Or you may need to think about mobility aids. Joining me to walk us through how to create a disaster preparedness plan that will take all of these considerations into account is the Senior Medical Advisor to National Disaster Operations at the American Red Cross. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Mary Casey Lockyer. Natural disasters are unpredictable. They can occur at any time, producing outcomes that can range from bad to worse. Now, that may sound just like a description of an MS relapse, but these types of extraordinary events can produce added challenges for people living with MS. The best way to prepare for any type of emergency is to have a disaster preparedness plan. And today, Mary Casey Lockyer, the Senior Medical Advisor to National Disaster Operations at the American Red Cross, is here to share how you can protect yourselves and your families in an emergency, so you can feel confident should a natural disaster occur close to where you live. Welcome to the podcast, Mary.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
When we talk about natural disasters, what kinds of emergencies and disasters are we talking about?
You're actually talking about notice and no notice events and sort of a personal household disaster. The American Red Cross responds to 60,000 single-family fires each year and many more multifamily fires. So preparing for that kind of household disaster is also very important. So remember to have that smoke alarm with a good battery in it. But we also have big, large events, no-notice events and notice events. Hurricanes, for instance, are actually a notice event. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, services like the National Weather Service, or a good website called Tropical Tidbits, track the formation of hurricanes and typhoons that may impact the U.S. and provides a prediction of the path of the storm many days out from expected impact. And so if you know something is coming and you're in a threat area where you might have a landfall for a hurricane, prepare, understand what you need to do and what authorities are asking you to do. A no-notice event could be a tornado, earthquake, or a fast-moving impact, wildfire. Stay alert to watches and warnings from local authorities for all these events. Get a weather radio and set it to your county frequency. The instructions for weather radios are included with the weather radio packet. If you are traveling, interestingly enough, get to know the county you will be visiting or use your phone to check out the county you are driving through, as watches and warnings are usually identified by county.
Are there any specific types of natural disasters that tend to occur more frequently than others?
Well, we've had 258 weather and climate disasters since 1980, with the overall damage costs reached or exceeded $1 billion. When it has been adjusted for the Consumer Price Index, that exceeds $1.75 trillion. Hurricanes and wildfires are occurring at increased rates in the past 5 years, and hurricanes are increasing in size, strength, and spinning up more rapidly. And so it's very important to understand those weather threats that may come your way. It's also important to plan because it can help you reduce fear, anxiety, stress, certain barriers, and make recovery process easier. People living with MS face unique challenges and have medical needs. Planning for these situations is critical to protecting yourself and your family.
You know, I live in California, and when we're not worried about wildfires, we tend to think about earthquakes. And one thing we tend to remember is that It's one of those no-notice situations. And what people talk about is the fact that it's never a question of if an earthquake is going to hit. It's only a question of when. And with that in mind, can you talk about the importance of advance planning when it comes to surviving a natural disaster?
Yeah, advance planning is really very important, but I think we need to recognize that it is not always easy. It is not easy to get a 30-day supply of your medication. As a matter of fact, it's almost impossible. You get that too soon to renew from your pharmacist. If you go and want to renew a week before your prescription is up. So that is very difficult. My advice there would be make sure if you can't have a 30-day supply, bring the medications you're using with you if you have to evacuate. Have the names and dosages written down. You know, there is an analog way of writing things down. And that is a piece of paper that's stuck in your wallet or your purse. And if you don't have connectivity or you don't have power for your cell phone, that analog way of making a list is extremely important. Have the names of your doctors and your pharmacies and how to contact them. And it is as simple as putting those little bits of pieces of paper in your wallet or your purse, because you never know when an earthquake is going to come. But it's also important to have that go pack, right? So whatever makes you comfortable, put in that go pack, change your clothes, water. You can get that kind of water that stays for a very long time in packets, maybe some food that you will need, but have that go pack.
You know, for a lot of different reasons, creating an emergency plan can really feel overwhelming. What's the best way to go about putting that plan together while keeping your stress level in check?
Well, I think it's always good to know your threats in your geographic area. Do you live along the coastline where you might run into a hurricane? And don't discount the fact that you live in the northern tier of the U.S., because we had Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy, whatever you want to call it, came into the New York City area, New Jersey. We've had other hurricanes that have come way up into the Northeast states. So don't discount that. Don't discount the fact that, well, a hurricane isn't going to happen here. I don't live on the Gulf Coast. You know, I live in the city of Chicago, but you can have a snowmageddon. You can have an ice storm. You can have loss of power. How are you going to handle those kinds of emergencies? But knowing what the threat is, I think, is somewhat comforting, because then you can really dive in and plan for that threat. And I think that is helpful to decrease your anxiety about planning.
And to that point, the American Red Cross reminds us that we need to be Red Cross ready for any urgent or unexpected situation. What does it mean to be Red Cross ready?
Well, I think we always talk about assembling emergency kit, and that's just what I was talking about with that go bag. I also think, especially for some of the northern tier cities, that you might want to put a go bag in your car when you're going out during the winter months, you know, a space blanket to keep you warm, some water, a couple of snacks. If you could get stuck in snow, I think that's really important. Make a plan. That's being Red Cross ready. Make a plan and really being informed. Stay up to date with what the weather forecasts are, what your emergency management authorities are telling counties to do. That's really important. But I also think you need to add what I call the trusted neighbor plan. Who will assist you with evacuation if you are unable to drive? Or who will assist you if you need accessible transportation? You might have to find that out from your county emergency management. Who will assist with helping you take your backpack or motorized scooter into your accessible van? And by the way, have you have at least a half a gallon tank of gas in that accessible van? That's Red Cross ready.
You know, we don't only want to be prepared for an emergency at home. We also need to think about emergency preparedness at work or at school. Who should we be talking to about emergency preparedness at our job or at school? And what questions should we be asking?
This is a really important point, because you're right. You're not always at your home when a disaster occurs. Talk with your facility safety officer or facility management lead. Most employers or most buildings have a facility safety officer, and they will be able to tell you what the building's emergency plan is. But also, I think you need to let that person know your needs. If you do use a motorized scooter, how would you evacuate if you were on the third or fifth floor? That's a really important piece. You need to let them know what your needs are, too. They should be able to tell you what the safety plan for the facility is. But don't hesitate to talk also with school principals. If you have children in school or even in universities or college, you need to talk to their safety departments about what are the plans if there is an emergency when your child is at one of those educational entities. And be assertive. Ask the principal, what will you do if my child has to shelter in place? Many educational organizations give you a form at the beginning of the year and say, if we have to shelter in place, do you want us to keep your child here at the school? Can you reunify with a family member or neighbor, or is it only reunification with the parents? But I really feel it's important that parents are really knowledgeable about what the school has planned and offer to help with that plan too.
Between symptom management and disease-modifying therapies, people living with MS need to think about their medications when they're thinking about disaster preparedness. You mentioned having a 30-day supply on hand if possible. We know that some of those medications require refrigeration. Do you have any tips for keeping MS medications safe and organized?
Yes. There's a really cool little device now. They're cooling pouches. You can find them in camping stores. And you can actually even fill it with an ice pack. You could also simply have a small cooler, but I suggest that you use ice packs and not just throw ice on top of it because that could be too cold. I've also heard some really great ideas about burying the medication in sand, which can get very cool and would keep insulate the medication from getting too warm. That's a kind of an extreme thing to do, but you might need to do that. But I really encourage those cooling pouches that I have seen in many camping stores and in emergency supply lists.
If someone has mobility issues, and you started talking about this a moment ago, if they use a walker or a wheelchair and they receive an evacuation order, what should they do?
Well, hopefully they have had a plan about how they're going to evacuate. And it may include that trusted neighbor plan. You know, are someone going to come and see, if Aunt Susie can get out and into her car safely and drive? She may be able to drive, even though she uses a walker, to evacuate as directed by authorities. But again, if at all costs, bring your assistive device with you. That sometimes is problematic. I've seen high water rescues where, of course, they're going to leave those assistive devices behind when they're rescuing people who need help with flooding waters. But I do tell you that in many, many shelters, especially in the Red Cross shelters, we are very focused on returning you to as much independence as when you were in your home. And we will make every effort to get the resources, both staff and stuff, that helped you maintain your independence in a Red Cross managed shelter. We also sometimes assist our county and state partners who are also managed shelters about the whole concept of, independent living and a non-medical model. And that's what Red Cross espouses to.
To your point, are all emergency shelters accessible? And in the event that they're not, what's the best way for someone who's living with MS, perhaps more progressive MS, where they are dealing with some significant physical disability, what's the best way for them to plan for a potential evacuation?
all shelters are required to be accessible, but not all shelters are accessible. And that could be because of the disaster. They just may not be able to use a building that is accessible because of the increased flooding, for instance. But I do encourage people actually to take part in community planning for disasters if you indeed need an assistive device. You know, go to the county town board meetings and ask questions, you know, when there isn't a disaster. Participate in exercises. That's a wonderful way to instruct emergency management responders what people need if they have mobility issues or advanced MS. And I highly encourage that. But I also encourage that you be assertive and, you know, look to your emergency management at the county and local jurisdictional level and say, put your hand up and say, hey, I want to help. I want to help our community. How are we going to evacuate individuals who need assistance with mobility devices? And I'm willing to help because that will go way far in getting you what you need, the resources you need.
It's not uncommon for people who have gone through a natural disaster to be traumatized. Some can even experience PTSD. What, when, and how should those feelings and experiences be addressed?
Well, you're used to being in a certain environment and knowing how to manage there. Of course, a disaster can change that. You might need to ask for help putting your home back in order or filling out forms for disaster relief agencies. You and your care partner or family members might experience anxiety, irritability, depression, isolation, or guilt. And actually, those are normal responses. If you don't know what is the damage in your home, did you have enough insurance, you are going to be anxious. You may be irritable. Shelters are a place of refuge, but they're not very comfortable. Just telling you, they're not very comfortable. So you may be irritable. You might, you know, we all know that. But those are kind of normal. It's when those normal reactions get to the point where it affects your eating or your sleeping or you're angry all the time. That's when you need to ask for help. And asking for help is wonderful. There are many organizations, voluntary organizations, active in disaster, that provide disaster mental health experts that can help comfort and guide you through the recovery stage. So you might also experience physical changes, including weakness, numbness or tingling, a heavy feeling in the arms, tremors, fatigue, or increase in allergies, colds, or flu. That's when you need to get to your health care provider and say, I'm not sure what's going on here, but this is what's happening. And this is the situation I'm in. And it's important to stay connected with your medical home, if you will call it that, or your primary care provider. Now, one little caveat to all that is your medical care provider might be impacted too. And so be prepared that they may not be able to respond to you right away. And so having that support system of both your household, but also your neighbors and your community is really important.
What types of emergency assistance programs are available to help people after a disaster?
Well, there's many emergency assistance programs, and it really depends on really how large the disaster is. If you go from the large disasters to the small, we have the Federal Emergency Management Agency, where you can apply for disaster relief if you have major and destroyed damage to your home. There's the Small Business Association in a large disaster. You have to apply for that and FEMA. That's a small business is a loan. However, it's very, very good for people who may need to put their house back together. There's many assistance programs. And on the sort of county or community level, know who your human service organizations are. Centers for Independent Living, area agencies on aging, elder care or elder programs. All of those are important. I know I centered on aging, but there's also programs for children too. And so that's important to understand what that human service sort of construct is in your community. And there are human constructs. Is it public health? What can public health offer you? All of that is important, along with whatever society you might belong to, such as the National MSSociety.org. The Veterans Administration has a very robust disaster recovery plan. So if you're a veteran, getting in touch with the Veterans Affairs is very important.
Well, as he just mentioned, the National MS Society supports people affected by MS through crises like the ones we've been talking about. What are some of the resources and services that the society can help with?
The MS navigators are ready to connect people to emergency shelters and other critical needs. They may also offer resources after the initial emergency, such as referrals for temporary living assistance, temporary medical equipment, access to medications, emotional support, or for other challenges.
Mary Casey Lockyer, thank you for all you do to help people get through and get past what are often some of the most frightening moments of their lives. And thanks for talking with me today.
Great to be on. Stay safe.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/274. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. And as the holiday season gets underway, please stay safe and make healthy choices.